Well, it happens that the Institute has had a special interest in revisionism. That is, what's a revisionism? Well, it's a revision of the standard government line, especially in regard to wars. And it has to do with any government. We're particularly concerned, of course, with the American government. When a war occurs, the government feels that it's obliged to propound a certain line about how the enemy was totally responsible for this war. We never did anything wrong. The enemy has committed terrible atrocities during the war. We've been gentlemen, sort of Robert E. Lee's all the time. And in the aftermath of the war, we acted with complete honesty and justice. Well, that's always a government line, and understandably, because war demands such sacrifice, especially modern wars, such sacrifices from the people, that they have to be totally bamboozled into thinking that they are fighting for the total and absolute good, and the enemy is demonic. So revisionism changes that. It doesn't have to totally reverse that, but it modifies that. If it weren't for revisionism, we'd still believe that the Spaniards blew up the Maine and Havana Harbor, of which there's no evidence whatsoever, and it's counterintuitive that the ones who would have to suffer from blowing up the Maine would believe that the United States entered World War I because of terrible violations of our rights by the Germans, rather than any plans that the administration had for getting into the war for its own larger purposes. We'd believe that, every single time the United States is attacked, Pearl Harbor is the outstanding example. But when the hostages were taken in Tehran during the Carter administration, when other things have happened in more recent American history, it's always foreigners who are just totally insane. I mean, they're psychotic for no good reason. Well, take the Japanese in Pearl Harbor. For no good reason, the Japanese decided to attack the United States. They had about, I think, about 10% of the GNP of the United States. They knew what America was like. And yet they decided to do, well, you know, crazy foreigners. All foreigners are essentially crazy. And the ones who attack the United States, even more crazy. Now, I say that the Mises Institute has a special interest in the revisionism. We have a book called Reassessing the Presidency. I mean, a nice, mild, judicious sort of title. In fact, it is a demolition of every president dealt with. In that volume, I happen to have an essay on Harry S. Truman, which is now, I think it's subtitled Advancing the Revolution. The original title I wanted, Lou said, no, we can't use it. That was Harry S. Truman, the little louse. A little heavy on value judgment, he thought. But the book that's relevant to what we're talking about today is this, okay? The Costs of War, America's Pyrrhic Victories, edited by John Denson. And it has essays by Joe Salerno, a number of essays by Murray, two essays by me, which are really worth the price of the book, which is not very much to begin with. A number of essays on the Civil War, the aftermath of it, and so on. Joe Stromberg and the Spanish-American War. And I say this in all sincerity. If you never buy another book in your whole life, this is the book you have to buy. Okay? That might seem like an extreme and judgment verging on the psychotic, but not really. This is a... Or in the bookstore, you can... this is the one that's not wrapped, and you can glance through this and see what you think. And much of what I can't talk about today will be included in my essay on the First World War. First World War was indeed, as I subtitled my essay goes, was indeed a turning point. Imagine to yourself a 20th century without Nazis and without communists. Because why? Well, as far as the communists went, Lenin's 10,000 Bolsheviks in 1914 would not have been able to overthrow the Imperial Russian army of 5 million. What had to be done was that the Imperial Russian army had to first be pulverized by the Germans. And then in the chaos that ensued and so on, the communists were able to come to power. As far as the Nazis go, if the monarchy had been retained in Germany, it's impossible to believe, first of all, that Hitler could have assumed the degree of power and control that he did, because he would have been under the leadership of the Kaiser. There was still a Kaiser. In Italy, there was a monarchy. So that when the time came and Italian public opinion and everybody turned against Mussolini, because obviously he'd gotten Italy into such a stupid, crazy war, Mussolini was dismissed because the monarch was still above Mussolini. What I'm saying is, if that situation had existed in Germany, it's very hard to see that the Nazis could even have come to power. I mean, there would have been nationalists and so on, but not these fanatical exterminationist anti-Semites who did come to power in Germany. So I'm saying the 20th century without communists and without Nazis. But there's another point about this, another aspect of the aftermath of the First World War that deserves to be mentioned. That's very important. There's a British historian who died some time back, a few years ago, named A.J.P. Taylor. I know that, you know, one distrusts these Brits who have three initials at the beginning but of their names, and rightfully so. But and he was a leftist historian also, but he was a good historian, a very provocative historian. He wrote an enormous amount. And this is how he starts one of his books about British history after 1914. Until August 1914, a sensible, law-abiding Englishman could pass through life and hardly notice the existence of the state, beyond the post office and the policeman. He could live where he liked and as he liked. He had no official number or identity card. He could travel abroad and leave the country forever without a passport or any sort of official permission. For that matter, a foreigner could spend his whole life in Britain without permit and without informing the police. Substantial householders were occasionally called on for jury duty. Otherwise, the state was had been reduced to a very small amount. The Englishman paid taxes on a modest scale, something like 8% of the national income in 1914. The state had been expanding to a certain extent. Since 1909, it had provided a meager pension for the needy over the age of 70, of which, of course, there were very few people who lived that long. Since 1911, it helped to ensure certain classes of workers on sickness and employment. Still, broadly speaking, the state, the British state, acted only to help those who could not help themselves, and it left adult citizens alone. All this was changed by the impact of the Great War. Now, so this is the really long run consequence of the Great War everywhere. The United States is also a very good example of that. Now, a book which you can also pick up downstairs in paperback, which is really a seminal work and a resource that you could go back to again and again, is by Robert Higgs, called Crisis and Leviathan. And it's about the growth of the American state since the time of the Civil War, principally through war. Higgs is an economist, first of all, an economic historian, but also a very good historian, Crisis and Leviathan. And what he shows is after every one of our wars, measure, the state expanded tremendously. After the war, it's diminished somewhat. But it never goes back to what it was before. It's a kind of ratchet effect. You know, it goes up and then goes down, but not back to the pre-war level. And in this way, state power has tended to expand and accumulate in the since the middle of the 19th century. Now, can everybody see this here? Can everybody see this map? Can you see this map? Can you see this map? Can you see this map? Okay. Now, this is, well, first of all, it's a board game called Diplomacy, but that's relatively trivial matter. It's a map of Europe in 1914. In my essay, I talk about the background of all of this, but by 1914, two power blocks confronted each other in Europe. There was, first of all, the power block that Bismarck had created. When Bismarck unified the Reich in 1871, his concern was that Germany should have a long period of peace, because any kind of great war, he thought, would tend to destabilize Germany. Germany was now united for the first time. There'd never been something called Germany. There'd been the Holy Roman Empire, something totally different. But now there was a Germany, and it was a somewhat fragile thing. It would take time for the different German peoples, the Prussians and Saxons and Bavarians and so on, to be knitted into one nation. So he wanted Germany to be at peace. And in order to do that, he set up a series of defensive alliances. That is, they would only come into effect if Germany was at war with two other powers, and Bismarck did not intend to bring Germany into war with any two other powers. So, ultimately, what happened was we have Germany. This is the Bismarckian Reich from Lithuania to Alsace-Lorraine, that was the center of what was called the Triple Alliance. Germany's ally was Austria-Hungary, and Austria-Hungary, which all the other countries exist in some form today, but Austria-Hungary was blown up after the First World War. And I don't really care for Winston Churchill that much, which you can read about in this book. Churchill said that the Austro-Hungarian Empire was it consists of all of these smaller peoples in Central Europe. But the Austro-Hungarian Empire was a way of these small people to stand together and to guard against being swallowed up by the great powers. It was a home for them. The Czechs and the Czechs and the Slovaks and the Poles and the Ruthenians, the Hungarians, the Romanians also, the Croats, the Serbs, Italians down here, the Hungarians, and the Germans, the Austrian Germans in the Austrian Crown lands and in the Sudetenland. As we'll see, our President Woodrow Wilson thought that monarchies are a terrible thing to begin with, and also every country, every people should have its own state. So Austria-Hungary was doomed as soon as they lost the war. Now, this Triple Alliance by 1914, notice how smoothly I do this. Okay. Okay. Is that up there? Oh. And people call me a technological moron. This is the world. This is the world in 1914. This Triple Alliance was faced by a Triple Entente of Great Britain, France, and Russia. Now, look at the world in 1914. Here's Germany. Germany has a few really miserable colonies. The Cameroons, German East Africa, Southwest Africa. They have part of New Guinea. They have a few of the Samoan Islands. And this is, I say miserable empire. They came very late to the thing. And the empire was worthless. It cost a lot more than the Germans ever got from it in any, by any measure, trade or investment or anything. After the Second World War, these colonies are taken away from Germany, which really was a good thing. But that's Germany. This is essentially Germany, okay? Now, it's a good idea if you're confronted with some opponent, to understand the world from the opponent's point of view. I mean, how does the opponent see the world? Well, there's Germany. On one side, we have France, this triple entente, of France, Britain, and Russia. On one side, we have France, the second best army in the world. On the other side, we have the Russian Empire that goes through 11 time zones and has an army larger than the German, French, and Austrian army put together. There are real problems with the Russians, but they do have this massive army. And then finally, they have Great Britain, the center, the only world power, and the center of a world empire. One quarter of the globe, one quarter of the population of the globe. This is an empire in which Egypt is one minor part. This is an empire that Canada and Australia are white dominions, but really a minor part. They have, there's the British Raj here. See this? The Raj, R-A-J, the British Dominion over India. And everything else you see, you find pink here. So the Germans are confronted with the French army, the Russians on the other side, and the British Empire, and also Britain, the financial capital of the world. From the German point of view, what can they depend on? The only thing they can depend on is their own army. Now, by 1914, there'd been a number of crises where Europe nearly went to war. And of course, all of the different European powers had contingency plans in the event of the Great War. I mean, you know, they don't wait until the last minute to come up with a plan of how to deal with their enemies. The most famous was the Schlieffen Plan, named after the head of the German General Staff, of what to do in the event of a war on two fronts. That is, a war with France and with Russia simultaneously. I'm kind of important in this institute, so I have recently learned from Lou that the position of commander-in-chief of the World Libertarian Armies is open. Now, a test of this, I'd be interested to know, what would you do if you were the Germans, the head of the German army, faced with this problem? This was a problem that was posed to the general staff. What to do in the event of a two-front war? Our old friend Murray Rothbard is not with us, unfortunately. His answer would have been to surrender. But we don't. That's out of the question. Okay, so what would you do? Here. Here, you look like a...
Me?
Not who? Who, me? No.
Me?
Who? Whenever, where you see this deadly laser pointed? Yes, yes, yes. You look like a military type.
I'm not.
Oh, okay. Who's a military type? Who's had any military... Okay, David. Take over France first? Why? What about splitting up your forces, half against France and half against Russia? Yes. A little louder.
If you're confronted with bigger forces than you, superior forces in numbers, you have to stay on the defense.
Or you have to do what?
Stay on the defense or...
But if you stay on the defense, the idea was a combined French and Russian forces could be enough to crack Germany like a walnut. Yes. What? Good. You have to deal with one of them. You have to knock out one of them real quick. No, but we're talking about the war breaking out now. Now, which one would be possible to... Who said that? Okay, why France?
It's smaller, less populated, smaller army, better chance.
Yeah, well, there's no way of knocking out Russia. I mean, you don't knock out Russia. You could eventually defeat Russia, but you don't knock out Russia because they do what they did against Napoleon, and that is simply retreat. And then you'd have to follow them there. But what are the French doing in the meantime? They're going to invade from the west. So the idea is to knock France out quickly. And this was the Schlieffen plan. To concentrate on knocking France out within just a few weeks. And once they knock France out, or at least the French have to retreat the south of the Loire, then the German army will be shuttled across Germany's excellent railroads to the Eastern Front to meet the Russians probably somewhere in East Prussia. And if the Russians, which they intended to do, mobilized and attacked. But in this plan, everything depended on timing. Because if they took too much time in knocking France out, then the Russians, although they were they'd be very slow in mobilizing, would in fact finally mobilize and then bring their forces into Germany. So quickly knock out France. And this terrain here on the actual French-German border tended to be hilly, mountainous in places. So the Schlieffen plan depended on going through Belgium. Okay? And, well, you can read about the crisis of the summer of 1914 in my essay, by the way, which is also online, without the footnotes, however, but in this book. And I have another essay online that is on lewrockwell.com under my archives on recent literature after this on the First World War. Okay, they'd have to go through Belgium, but Belgian neutrality had been guaranteed by the powers when Belgium was created in the 1830s. Nonetheless, they might have to do that. Now, there's this crisis that starts with the assassination of the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne by Bosnian Serbs. Now, Serbia is a little country here, as you can see, but there are also Serbs who live within the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the Serbs have as their mentor Russia. This has been for a long time a kind of sentimental relationship between the Orthodox Russians and the Orthodox Serbs. The Russians had masterminded a Balkan League to try to throw the Ottomans totally out of Europe in the Balkan Wars of 1912-1913. And the end result is that you have a pretty formidable, small but formidable Serbian army now. The Serbs are intent on uniting all of the South Slavs, including even the Croats and Slovenes, but especially creating a Greater Serbia. Why not? Prussia had created a Greater Germany. Piedmont had created a Greater Italy. The Serbs say, you know, why should we be left out? However, the Serbian intention depended on the destruction of Austria-Hungary. Because if the South Slavs were allowed to become independent, then the Czechs and the Romanians would have their claim on Transylvania, and the Czechs and maybe even Slovaks would withdraw the end of Austria-Hungary. Austria-Hungary was the only halfway reliable ally that Germany had. The Italians, just as soon as they entered into this Triple Alliance, began negotiating with the French behind the backs of the Germans. The Italian politicians are, throughout this whole story, are unbelievably contemptible. All of the, as far as I'm concerned, all of the political leaders of all of the powers deserved to be tried and hanged. The Italians deserve to be captured by Al Qaeda. Let's put it that way. So Italy could not be depended on. So what were the Germans going to do? If Austria-Hungary were broken up, especially into small Slavic states with great Russian influence, the whole southern border of Germany would be vulnerable. Germany would become militarily indefensible. So the Germans had to back up the Austrians. And the Austrians decided to, this was the last straw, the assassination of the Archduke. They were going to end this, the Serbian threat once and for all. So there was the ultimatum. This is a period of a few days, the end of July and the first few days of August of 1914, is probably the best testified to period in history, because everybody was sending telegrams from their capital to their different embassies. People kept journals. People afterwards wrote memoirs. So what happened in these few days is very well attested to. But I'll talk about the war guilt clause afterwards. Okay, so the Austrians send a memorandum, an ultimatum to Serbia, deliberately worded so that the Serbs would have to turn it down. That is, the Serbs would have to allow the Austrian police to come into Serbia to find out who these assassins were. But it turns out the assassins were directed by the head of Serbian military intelligence. Serbian government didn't want anybody to find out that. So the Austrians demanded that. The Serbs finally turned down the ultimatum. Now, back in Russia, so far it's just Austria against Serbia. Back in Russia, Sasanov, Russian foreign minister, when he saw the text of the Austrian ultimatum to Serbia, cried out, "C'est la guerre européenne." It is the European war. The Serbs, the Austrians intend to destroy Serbia. Really, they did, to divide it up. Russia would not permit that. Russia would back up Serbia. Germany would back up Austria. The French would back up the Russians. And this would be indeed the European war. Well, this is what started to happen. Remember, the Schlieffen Plan depends on quickness, on rapidity. The poor Tsar, but at the end, you know, William II or Wilhelm II is the Kaiser, and Nicholas II is the Tsar, the last of the Tsars. They're cousins, descended from Queen Victoria. And at the very end, the Kaiser sends telegrams to Nicky, signed Willie, because they are cousins and friends and all. Your generals and your admirals tell you to mobilize, but don't. If you mobilize, my generals and admirals are going to tell me we have to mobilize, and then we have war. And there's no way of telling how the war is going to end. How is the war going to end for the Tsar and his family?
Yeah, yeah. No, very bad.
Yeah. Benjamin. Okay, you don't have to be so graphic, Benjamin. Okay? Are they going to be shot to death in the cellar by Bolsheviks? Not only the Tsar, his whole family. And the head of the execution squad afterwards, the communist execution squad, said that just before he killed her, he had the Tsarina. That's a story to dine out on for a long time, isn't it? So the Tsar and his family is going to be murdered. The Kaiser goes into exile in Holland. He's there in 1940 when another German leader sends his troops in, lived a long time. So it's going to destroy those dynasties, and the Kaiser was perfectly right about it. But there was no way of stopping the Austrians and Germans, with German backing, were intent on destroying Serbia. The Russians were intent on defending Serbia. And the Russians then started to mobilize. General mobilization along the whole front here. If the Russians mobilized too quickly, it's the end of the Schlieffen Plan, because the Germans couldn't afford to send their army into France with the Russians mobilizing so quickly. So the Germans send an ultimatum to the French and to the Russians on August 1st. To the Russians, cease general mobilization at once. To the French, what would you do, hypothetically speaking, in the event of a war between Germany and Russia? And if you promise to remain neutral, kindly hand over the fortresses at Toul and Verdun, which control the northern approaches to Paris, to be garrisoned by the German army. In other words, you know, surrender. Those ultimatums were rejected, and the German army now sets off to the conquest of France. Britain had a big problem. It did not have a formal alliance. It had a cordial understanding, an entente cordiale with France. But over the years, there have been secret conversations between the French military, British military, the politicians, and so on. And the French had every reason to believe that if they were involved in a war with Germany, the British would come to their defense. However, the British public didn't know about these commitments. Parliament didn't know about the commitments. The majority of the British cabinet didn't know about the commitments. So they were in a real quandary. How was this the government going to get Britain into the war, which honor demanded, since the French were depending on it? And the Germans solved their problem. They invaded Belgium. And now the British foreign minister could go in front of the House of Commons and say, Britain must get into this war, because Britain has always been a defender of the rights of little people. Somebody in the back said, what about Ireland? And he was taken out and shot. So Britain is now in the war, and that's a key, because if Britain hadn't been in the war, we wouldn't have been in the war. Now, a number of things happened immediately. First, and the most important, is the British hunger blockade. There were rules of blockade that were pretty well accepted, and the British violated all of them. They simply set mines, permanent, you know, not floating mines, but permanent mines, in the entrance to the English Channel and in the entrance to the North Sea. They knew where the mines were, of course, so they could, any ships that they would want to allow to get in, they could. They would guide them through the minefields and so on. But these effectively blockaded Germany. But it was not legal by international law. By international law, you have to have a close-in blockade with surface ships. Besides, the British made up a list of contraband, which nobody else agreed to, because, among other things, it included food for the civilian population. You know, Americans tend to think of the British, the English especially, as sort of effete, right? Drinking tea with their pinky up and, as we Americans say, living on Gay Street. It's not wimps who create the greatest empire in the history of the world, right? Who create this empire that spans the globe and so on. So when it comes to it, when it comes to their own interest, the English can be totally ruthless. And this is what they intended to do. Churchill was the First Lord of the Admiralty. He said, we intend to starve the German civilian population, men, women, children, invalids, into submission by denying them food. If you've ever read the best literary work to come out of, or anyway, the most famous literary work to come out of the First World War, All Quiet on the Western Front, by Remarque, okay, you'll see towards the end, the German soldiers are starving, they're starving back home, and so on. So that really was the most powerful tool that or weapon that was used on either side in the war, just grinding the Germans down. The British also have been superb in propaganda. Anything that in any conflict that happens, the British are always on the side of, well, you know, fair play, decency, justice, the Protestant way of life, virtue, all the good things. And if they have to smash a face in order to promote these values, well, that's also necessary. The British now started with their propaganda campaign. And the first thing that Americans hear about this German army that's going through Belgium is that they are unbelievably, they act like unbelievable savages. These are the stories that start coming out of Belgium, the Belgian atrocities, as they're known. They are not only killing babies, but sort of tossing babies from one bayonet to another. They're crucifying soldiers on barn walls. Raping nuns is a three times a day activity for any German soldier, right? And Americans are a little shocked by this. After all, there are a lot of Germans in our country. Right? Cincinnati is a German city. St. Louis is a German city. Milwaukee, millions and millions of Germans. Nobody ever said that they were the wittiest people in the world, right? And as far as German cooking goes, the famous saying is that you eat a German meal and then 72 hours later you're hungry all over again. However, nobody ever thought this of the Germans. The Germans who lived in America, yeah, they're decent people. Everybody welcomed them as neighbors. But now, gee, it must really be, as the British are saying, that it is a fight between civilization and barbarism. Lucky for the British, they had an administration in Washington that was, well, Anglophile does not describe it sufficiently. That's a whole story in itself. The President of the United States at this time was... Who was the President of the United States in the First World War? What? What'd you say? I said, I am calling on this young man, because whoever doesn't get it right, of course, doesn't get any more food at our conference. Now, who was the president? Yes. Thomas Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson. And he was an Anglophile. His great confidant, Colonel House, was an Anglophile. The American ambassador to England, to Britain, was so Anglophile that he even disgusted the Brits. The administration was filled with Anglophiles, people who thought that England really was fighting our fight, except for the Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan. Well, there was a famous case of the Lusitania. You know, all these mystery ships in American history, say the USS Maine in Havana Harbor, or the Lusitania, not an American ship, but a crucial factor, or those battleships in a row, one after the other at Pearl Harbor, just lined up, or the U.S. Navy destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. You know, these odd things that happened to the ships in American history. Lusitania, which is a British passenger ship, headed from New York to Liverpool, is encountered by a German submarine right here, south of Ireland, and sunk. The German submarine captain, when he raises his periscope, sees a cliff in front of him. He sees the most famous ship in the world, the Lusitania. And Lusitania happens to be carrying munitions. Churchill is the First Lord of the Admiralty. He had already given orders, which the Germans had captured, that any passenger ship confronted by a German submarine that comes to the surface should turn around and ram the submarine. The submarines were very fragile in those days. So the German captain just torpedoes the Lusitania. Now, the outrage was great in certain circles in America. You know, in the millions and millions of farmers in the South, the Midwest, the miners in the West, they really didn't care about these Americans who were traveling to England in the course of the war. What Americans do you suppose are traveling to England in the middle of a war? They're going to England for the Henley Regatta, for Ascot, for the season, this is May, for the season and so on. It's the Anglophile elite in America. It's the blue bloods from Boston to Washington and centered in New York City. They're the ones who cry bloody murder about the Lusitania. Now, the U.S. doesn't get into war at this time. This is May 1915. But Wilson sets down the policy. The Germans will be held strictly accountable for any loss of American life through submarine action, regardless of the flag of the ship that the Americans are traveling on. Now, that's unheard of. I mean, It's the country whose flag it is that has a responsibility for dealing with attacks or in one way or another. But any American traveling on it, and this is regardless of the fact that the ship might be carrying munitions and that the merchant ship might be armed. Okay, merchant ships are not permitted to be armed. Well, Brian, the U.S. Secretary of State, resigns over this. He says, I'm not going to put up with this. We are sanctioning a policy of the British sending mixed cargoes of bullets and babies across the Atlantic, and we're going to somehow hold only the Germans responsible if something goes wrong. And the Germans say, no, what are you talking about? President Wilson, why don't you say that Americans have the right to travel unmolested, let's say from Paris to Brussels, and if somehow they are shot at by Germans, then the Germans will be held responsible. Because that's what you did with this British munitions-carrying ship, going through a war zone, and in fact a submarine zone, and the Americans were killed, and now you're holding us responsible. Why don't you say that Americans have the right to travel? If they traveled from Paris to Brussels, they'd be going through something called what? Something called the Western Front, right. But nonetheless, the Germans said, okay, we'll calm it down. But this was always in abeyance. Now, the British were violating American rights by setting up this illegal blockade and not permitting, according to international law, a ship going from a neutral port, New York, to a neutral port, Rotterdam, had the right to carry anything it wanted. And it certainly had the right to carry food. But the British were stopping such American ships. They were stopping American mail. They're setting up a blacklist of American companies that had anything to do with Germany and preventing them from engaging in international trade. And the Americans said, okay, we're complaining to the British also. We're not letting them get away with it. Okay. The man who replaced Bryan as Secretary of State was Robert Lansing. After the war, he wrote his memoirs. He said, in dealing with the British government, that is, in complaining about their violation of American rights, there was always in my mind the conviction that we would ultimately become an ally of Great Britain, and that it would not do, therefore, to let our controversies reach a point where diplomatic consequences gave place to action. He said, once we joined the British in the war, we would presumably wish to adopt some of the policies and practices which the British adopted. For we too then would be aimed to, quote, destroy the morale of the German people by economic isolation, which would cause them to lack the very necessaries of life. So this is a sham. This is a facade, the Americans complaining to the British, as the Secretary of State afterwards admitted. He said, everything we did was submerged in verbiage. It was done with deliberate purpose. It ensured the continuance of the controversy, and left the questions unsettled, which was necessary in order to leave the country, this country, free to act and even act illegally when it entered the war. So, if you hear that after the First World War, the American people became terrible, dreadful isolationists, they knew they had been lied into this war. Here, the Secretary of State is admitting that there had been a system of lies, because we intended to get in on the side of the British anyway, and we wanted to do what the British were doing, starving the Germans to death. So what happens then finally is that, by the way, the best book on the Wilson administration and the war is by Walter Karp, K-A-R-P, called The Politics of War. The Politics of War. I think it is in print again. And you can follow in detail President Wilson's changing policies. What was behind Wilson's actions ultimately was his desire to get into the war in order for America to have a leading voice in the creation of the New World Order. And the feeling was, a legitimate feeling, the British and the French have sacrificed so much that we have to get into the war, and we have to get into the war in a big way. We have to be what British sportsmen call blooded. They don't allow fox hunting in England anymore. But when they did, you're a young fella, and your dad or your uncle is taking you out now with a group to hunt foxes for the first time. First time you kill a fox, they take the animal and smear blood on your cheek. You're blooded. That is, now you have taken part in killing. You have killing a legitimate object, an animal like a fox, and you now have a different status. So the American people, Wilson felt, had to be blooded before we had a right to sit at the peace conference, and Wilson to impose his view of the New World Order with the League of Nations at the center of it. Now, I agree with H.L. Mencken, who said that he despised every American president that he lived under. I have disliked at least disliked every American president. I think maybe the last decent American president was Grover Cleveland, who came from Buffalo, by the way, and that's no accident. You can have debates about this. You know, was Truman worse than Roosevelt? Was Roosevelt worse than Lincoln? Was Lincoln worse than... those are healthy debates. Those are libertarian debates. You know, which was the worst monster? But the one that I really dislike in a gut kind of way is Woodrow Wilson. And the reason was that he was so unbelievably sanctimonious. H.L. Mencken, you guys know Mencken, right? M-E-N... C-K-E-N. He was a libertarian. He was the most famous American literary critic of the 20s and 30s. He's a joy to read even today. And Mencken said, the problem with Wilson was that he was personally deeply convinced that he was the logical candidate for the first vacancy in the Trinity. Sanctimonious doesn't begin to capture this guy. And I talk about the details of this just to give you, you know, America went through a horrible campaign against civil liberties, worse than the Second World War, really, except for the incarceration of the Japanese Americans. But terrible, terrible. And anybody who criticized the war was thrown into jail under the Espionage and Sedition Act. There was a socialist leader named Eugene Debs. Now, look, Americans here, you'll tell me, right? Wilson goes down in history as the great idealist. Is that not so? A deeply humane man. And if America had been sensible enough to follow his ideas, going into the League of Nations, there wouldn't have been a Second World War. However, tragically, Wilson was not able to carry out his great vision. Okay, this is the Wilson. Okay, among thousands and thousands of people who were imprisoned for expressing their views was the leader of the Socialist Party, Eugene Debs. He told a socialist convention in Ohio, we're in this war because of the bankers. He was arrested, tried, sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. Okay, once the war was over, other countries had amnestied their political prisoners. In 1920, Debs was said to be dying in prison, and petitions came to the White House for Wilson to pardon Debs. He said, I will never pardon Debs. He was a traitor. He stabbed our soldiers in the back and all, you know, all the stuff they say. So this is the humanitarian. This is the idealist, vindictive to the nth degree, to the last drop. Wilson finally got us into war. How that happened was that the hunger blockade was taking its toll. It's been estimated, by the way, that about 750,000 Germans succumbed. You don't literally die of starvation. The Irish didn't generally die of starvation, what happens is malnutrition sets in, and you become susceptible to all kinds of diseases. And about 750,000 Germans died because of this hunger blockade, which was continued after the war until the Germans finally gave in and signed the Treaty of Versailles, continued for months. So the German generals and admirals told the Kaiser, our only hope now is to bring England to its knees. And the only way we can do it is through unrestricted submarine warfare. We know the Americans, or Wilson will bring the Americans in. But we hope that before that happens, before a substantial number of Americans come, we'll have forced the English to surrender. So in January of 1917, the Germans declare the waters around the British Isles to be subject to unrestricted submarine warfare. Any ship entering is subject. Merchant, more ships, of course, are always legitimately subject to being sunk, but any merchant ship of any nationality subject to be sunk. And this was their great gamble, and it didn't work. And we finally did get... and then the time came when some Americans were killed. It wasn't any massive amount. The massive amount was with the Lusitania, and that was only 128. But a number of Americans are killed, and now Wilson goes before Congress, as Roosevelt will also. You know, an odd thing. We have these presidents who like to grab power as much as they can, everywhere they can. And yet, they were, ashamed enough after they read the Constitution to feel they actually had to go to Congress and ask for a declaration of war in the old-fashioned days, right? It's a sign of how things have changed. When prohibitionists wanted to prohibit the sale of alcohol by the federal government, they felt that they had to have a constitutional amendment, that otherwise the federal government had no jurisdiction over the consumption of alcohol by Americans. Then that was the 18th Amendment. Nowadays, the federal government does any damn thing it wants, right? It prohibits drugs, any kind of drugs. It prohibits this, guns, prohibits that, and so on, without any constitutional amendment, because now people feel the federal government can do anything it wants. So Wilson went before Congress and said, we have to get into this war. And it wasn't because of these alleged violation of American rights. It was to make the world itself safe for democracy, at last to make the world itself free. Okay? This is the line of global democracy and America's responsibility to spread it throughout the world, which we see in action today in the American government. And he said, here I stand. I can do no other. Very Protestant. Everybody knew that went back to Martin Luther, your stage, your Kandislanders, before a Catholic tribunal. Here I stand. I can do no other. Why? Because justice. I'm so fired by justice. I'm burning up with the sense of justice and righteousness. And we have to declare war. And the whole establishment there went crazy. They weren't crazy for this war out in the Great Plains and the southern farms. The American blacks were not really anxious for America to spread democracy and justice throughout the world. They were busy enough avoiding getting lynched. And the German Americans didn't like it. The Irish Americans didn't like it. But the people who counted in America liked it very, very much. Now, in Robert Higgs's book, Crisis and Leviathan, you can read the details. This is the creation of the great American state. They nationalized the railroads. Herbert Hoover is put in charge of all of food and fuel production. Bernard Baruch is put in charge of rationing of scarce minerals and scarce commodities. Rent control is put in for the first time. in a few places, New York and Washington. The draft, the first time Americans now are drafted to fight in a foreign war. And on and on. The FBI, well, it's called? Not the Federal Bureau of Investigation, but I think, I don't know. The Bureau of Investigation, I think, is set up for the first time. A national police force. And on and on and on. And once the war is over, many of these things are rescinded, but never back to what it was before. And a prohibition is put in, by the way. And we go through, as I think Mark Thornton talked about that, we go through that great experiment, and Americans treating themselves like children, keeping themselves from drinking because of the police. The only people who have ever done that. God bless America. And the attack on civil liberties, the attack on Germans, a lot could be said about that. That went on to the point where I think a lot of people had to consider it just a joke. The speaking German in public was prohibited in a lot of places. Speaking on German on the telephone was prohibited altogether because, you know, who knew what they might be saying. German language papers, of which there were dozens and dozens, were closed down. Irish papers also were closed down. Symphony orchestras made their contribution. For the rest of the war, they were not going to play any music by German composers. Well, I ask you, how many times can you listen to Bolero, really? You know, or the March Slav or something. But, German Americans were persecuted, were treated the way communists were going to be treated afterwards. And then finally, the Treaty of Versailles. Let me just spend a minute and show you this map. Okay. Marshal Foch, who became the supreme commander of the Allied forces on the Western fronts, when they were finished at Paris, the Paris Peace Conference, says, "This is not a peace. This is a truce for 20 years." They had a choice. They could have undone the Bismarck Reich and reduced Germany to small states, or they could have recognized reality that Germany was a power, just as France had been recognized as a power after the Napoleonic Wars. Instead, they encumbered Germany with a lot of details you can read anywhere, really, but you can read in my essay. Also, limiting its armies, taking away its colonies, created a great Poland with the Polish corridor. There's Danzig, German city taken away because Poland needed port on the Baltic. This thing called Czechoslovakia was created. The Czechs and Slovaks had never been together in the same country. And this Czechoslovakia, by the way, had more Germans than Slovaks in something called the Sudetenland. Austria was prohibited from joining together with Germany. This was another violation of the principle of self-determination. The Treaty of Versailles and the whole Paris Peace Conference was a whole mess. This is a detail. Oh, the British and French, of course, were fighting for world democracy. There were problems with that, and that was that they all got together and divided up the spoils even while the war was going on. One reason why the Ottoman Empire came in to the war on the side of Germany was that they knew what was in store for them if the Russians had won the war. And the secret treaties with Britain and France gave the Russians Constantinople and the Straits with the over there. And the Allies promised the Arabs that they would support the independence of Arab countries if the desert Arabs joined the Allies against the Turks. However, at the same time, they promised the Zionists that they would support a national homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine, the Balfour Declaration. So these were somewhat contradictory. The British got, this doesn't show the Eastern Mediterranean. The British got Palestine as a mandate. They created something called Iraq out of a number of different Turkish controlled provinces, with Kurds and different kinds of Arabs and so on, took away the province of Kuwait, made that a separate little principality, totally under British control. Iraq was under British control. The king had been was appointed by the British. The French were given Syria, and the French, out of Syria, carved something which had never existed before called Lebanon, with the city of Beirut. There was something called Mount Lebanon, something different that had existed. Why did they do this? Because they wanted a Christian-majority country as a foothold in the Middle East, and at that time, Lebanon was. Are Palestine and Lebanon problems to this day? Is Iraq, with its strange, bizarre demographics, a problem to this day? Sure. And you can credit British and French imperialism with that. Could be said, but I know that you're all going to be buying this book. I know. You have so many things to spend money on. You have to go and see Halloween number 15 or something, other important movies. You can get, as I say, you can get this online on my archives on lewrockwell.com. Anybody who wants to leave now, you can. Not stampede. I mean, how embarrassing. But we'll maybe take one or two comments or questions. Yes.
Okay. You mentioned early on, and I thought this was extremely interesting, that Austria-Hungary was constructed in such a way.
This is the new map.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
But you pointed out that Germany would be vulnerable in the southeast area. Yeah.
No, southern boundary, sure.
In Austria, the German-speaking people, so Austria, if the empire did break itself up, they would still be abutted by Germany.
Well, it depends. No, it depends. But this would have been the Czech lands. The Sudetenland was historically part of Bohemia and Moravia, which are the Czech lands. So presumably, Czech republic or a Czech state would have been set up with a majority, a Slavic majority.
Right. I can accept that. It doesn't seem like German. It seems to me that you painted a picture that Germany actually was the linchpin to the war. If Germany would have said, we don't really care what happens to Austria, then there wouldn't have been a war.
Right. And if Russia had said, we don't care about Serbia, we're okay. In fact, Serbia is a totally different, it has nothing to do with our national defense, then there wouldn't have been a war either. All of the government elites believed that their vital interests were involved. The British believed if France was overrun by Germany, Germany would have continental hegemony. The French believed that if the Germans and Austrians were able to defeat the Russians, then France would have no ally in Europe and France would be at Germany's mercy. The Germans believed that the Russians were just biding their time until their industrialization took place, until they were strong enough. Then they would attack Austria and then Germany would be vulnerable. So they all believed they were doing it on behalf of their own national security. Our military expert, go ahead. Do you have
you mentioned Colonel Mendel Haas.
Yeah.
And, I know he had influence on domestic policy. I was wondering if he also had influence on foreign policy.
More of an influence on foreign policy. He was Wilson's very close confidant. I wouldn't say like Karl Rove, because Wilson wasn't a moron, but Colonel Haas was like Harry Hopkins to President Roosevelt afterwards. Well, he was from Texas and a Democrat. I don't think it was a separate thing that some people say we went into war to guarantee the loans that the House of Morgan had made to Britain. And that's certainly true that they'd made big loans to Britain, which were dependent on Britain surviving the war and not being crushed. And the House of Morgan didn't make any bones about it, that they were totally behind the British war effort, as the New York banks in general were, except for the Jewish banks, which were tended to be pro-German, because the Germans treated the Jews a lot better than the Russians did, until the Balfour Declaration. And that was one of the purposes of the Balfour Declaration, of getting Zionists behind the war effort. But international finance certainly played a role. One last point. Yes. Sorry, Jennifer.
Free market, a good way to keep this from
what is it? What? I'm sorry, what?
Global free markets in the future, do you think that's the best solution to the problem of this type of thing happening?
Well, certainly I'm in favor of global free markets. It depends on what role the state takes. You know, the American government's position now is that they're promoting free trade. Like they have the North American Free Trade Agreement and now the Central American. And as I think Walter Williams even says, I mean, you don't have to be a total Austrian or libertarian. This North American Free Trade Act, the NAFTA, why do you need a book of 700 pages to enforce free trade, to establish free trade? What you need is simply to get rid of tariff barriers unilaterally, I would say, and then you have free trade. But this is government-managed trade. And as far as globalization goes, well, then the U.S. government decides this country now can engage in free trade with us, but that country can't because we don't agree with its regime, and we're trying to overthrow its regime. So that globalization on the basis of voluntary exchange, as far as I'm concerned, is terrific, but not managed by the government. Well, thanks very much, and go on. Good question.